WHYY is proudly supported by Penn Medicine. From groundbreaking discoveries to life-saving care, Penn Medicine's innovation is helping to change lives, one moment, one treatment, one patient at a time.
This is Fresh Air. Divorce may strike some as antithetical to traditional American values, but historian Glenda Riley has found there's a long tradition of divorce in America. Riley teaches American history at Ball State University. Her new book is called Divorce, an American Tradition. One of her previous books is about women on the American frontier. I asked Riley if there were common beliefs about divorce that she hopes her new book will dispel.
Well, I think one of the most important ones is that most contemporary Americans think that the high divorce rate is a 20th century phenomenon, mostly a phenomenon of the 1980s and 1990s. And they fail to realize that divorce has a very long history in this country, in fact, dating back to the Puritans.
What about the rate of divorce today? It's still higher than it's ever been, isn't it?
Well, the rate of divorce is extremely high. It's the highest in the world, and of course it's the highest in our history. But that's a little more complex topic than it first looks like on the surface. For one thing, people live longer these days, and so marriages that would have ended with the death of one spouse or the other now often end in divorce. Also, people divorce in multiple numbers these days, so that one person might contribute four or five divorces to the divorce rate. And also, I've speculated that it's not quite as easy to desert as it used to be because of Social Security numbers and insurance and property and computers, so that there are some reasons for that very high divorce rate besides the divorces themselves.
Now, your book says that the first divorce in the United States dates back to colonial days, to the Puritans. And you say that for them, divorce was a matter of civil law, not religion.
Right. When the Puritans first came to this country in 1620, they immediately instituted a reform that marriage should be a civil procedure rather than ecclesiastical. And that was part of their break from the Anglican Church. It was also part of the ideas they'd picked up during their time in Holland. And that opened the way for divorce eventually, because if marriage is a civil contract, then it follows logically that that contract can be dissolved. So it was 1639 when the first woman got a divorce. And it's interesting that it was a woman. You might think that men would be the first to go to the divorce court since they had more legal savvy and more money and more mobility. But she pled that her husband already had a wife. And the court immediately granted her a divorce and was quite hard on him in terms of what he had to pay. And then they even deported him, punished him, and then deported him.
When America got its independence from England and states started creating their own divorce laws, what were some of the regional differences you could see early on in the history of America?
Between the various regions and the various states?
Yeah.
Well, New York was extremely conservative. Alexander Hamilton first proposed that divorces should just be given for the biblical reason of adultery, and New York stuck to that until very, very recently. Massachusetts, as you might expect, was rather liberal and had a large number of grounds for divorce. And I'm saying, as you might expect, because the Puritan background of already granting divorces for many years. The South slowly caught up. Virginia began to grant divorces in the early 1800s, and then the legislature got very disgusted with the drain on their time. So they shifted it to the courts, and as they shifted it, they gave the judges a great deal of discretion, which actually liberalized divorce in the state of Virginia. Now, one of the reasons that we have so many state laws, differing state laws on divorce, is, again, the precedents that were set in the colonial times. Every colonial government wanted to govern their own citizens' marital status, and so it established a precedent of states' rights in that area. And later, a reform movement came along that said, well, no, let's have a national law and all do it the same way so that you won't have people escaping New York to Nevada, for example. And most of the states resisted that and did not want to give up that state's rights. So that's why we have such a complicated situation today with divorce law.
How did some places in the West, like Reno, Nevada, become divorce mills?
Well, there's a very clear answer to that. In the western areas, as they were settled, haste was very important. If you wanted to settle up and you wanted to attract people to your region, then you needed to give them the right to vote, the right to practice their profession, the right to hold office as quickly as you could. And usually it was a matter of 10 days, 30 days residence, and you could become a citizen of that area. Well, then it follows that to take other illegal actions, 30 days, 60 days, 90 days, seems very long by comparison. So Western areas often said 60 days residence for a divorce. And that attracted people from other regions who then came and took advantage of that. And there is no law in this country that says you have to be an American citizen. So people even came from other countries to take advantage of that. And it was not just Reno, but before Reno, long before Reno, places like Sioux Falls, South Dakota, and Fargo, North Dakota were known as divorce mills. They were actually forerunners to Reno. But as soon as there was a conservative backlash and criticism, then they began to tighten up their laws. I think in the case of Nevada, they saw that it brought in the tourist dollar, it brought in gamblers, it really became very crucial in a roundabout way, not divorce itself, but the people it brought into the state to establish that residency, it became crucial to their economy.
Did you travel to Reno for background for your book?
I did.
What's it like now in terms of divorce, since divorce has become easier to get in other states?
Well, the statistics show that since no-fault divorce, migratory divorce in Reno has dropped off. But another interesting thing has developed in that now people aren't shopping so much for the lowest residency in divorce, but they're shopping for where they can get the best settlement. So people are still getting migratory divorces, and they still do go to places like Reno because they get better property settlements. But that in itself has then created a terrible ball of legal wax because they go back to their own state, and the other partner refuses to agree with that property settlement or child care settlement, and then it often ends up in another suit in their home state in an attempt to decide which judgment will prevail.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Glenda Riley. She's a historian and the author of the new book, Divorce, An American Tradition. We'll talk more about divorce after the short break. This is Fresh Air. Historian Glenda Riley is my guest, and we're talking about divorce. Let's look at divorce today with no-fault divorce in many states. What do you think of the no-fault divorce laws and how well they're working?
Well, they're not working well at all from the viewpoint of many women and children. And I remember no-fault, and I remember how we felt about no-fault. People generally, especially feminists, thought it was going to be wonderful, that it was going to be a step toward equalizing relationships between men and women, that it was going to bring women up to an economic and a psychological par with men. And what happened in reality was that women did not move into the job market as fast as we expected. They did not receive equal pay as fast as we expected. They did not get educational opportunities as fast as we expected. So the reality is that in no-fault divorce, women come away with less than equal by far. For example, if they've stayed home and they don't have the job experience that the man in the marriage does, yes, they get half the property, but they walk out without the same earning ability. And so after a divorce, typically a man's income goes up and a woman's drops. Typically also she gets the children, so here she's trying to either go back to school or get a job, upper job experience, and raise children at the same time and pay their expenses. And of course, many men default. Our default rate is very high in child support, so that leaves her without that income.
Do you see any movements afoot that would like to tighten up the divorce laws and make divorce more difficult to get?
Yes, there are regular outcries in that area, and certainly from churches, moral majority, and I think that their stand is quite understandable. My own position is that divorce is not the problem, that it's marriage, and that we need to look at the other end. We need to start educating people better for marriage, making them think more about why they choose a mate, helping them choose a mate, and instead of worrying about divorce ruining the marriage, worrying about the choices in courtship and what the people do during the course of divorce, the course of marriage. For example, one of the things I argue in the book is that we need to give more support in this society to existing marriages. People are two-earner families now. We need to give child care, take that stress off the marriage. And it seems to me that's a way of avoiding divorce, by providing those services to existing marriages.
From your historical research, do you think stricter divorce laws would ever succeed in keeping relationships together?
No, and that's one of the things I argued throughout the book very strongly, is that historical evidence shows that if you have a strict divorce law, as in New York, many people left New York and went to Nevada and got migratory divorces. There was a very high annulment rate, a very high legal separation rate in New York, both of which fell dramatically after New York liberalized their divorce laws. There were also firms in New York that gave you a package deal. Now remember, the only ground is adultery, so you hired the firm who set you up with a hotel, a partner, a photographer, witnesses, shammed an adultery case, and then took all this into court and got your divorce. So it seems to me from that and other instances that people will find a way around their marriage. They'll take other partners, they'll drum up a separation, they'll think of a reason to get an annulment, they'll live separately. So to have a strict divorce law is not going to keep people together.
I guess the rate of lying would go up, because if you lie creatively, you can make your relationship conform to the stricter divorce law.
Well, that's another interesting thing in dealing with divorce documents. Several scholars and historians lately have started pulling out divorce petitions and saying, well, now this tells us a lot about marriage. And I agree, it tells something about a marriage. But I think also you have to be very careful in using divorce petitions as sources, because people who went in for divorces had to meet the legal requirements of that state. So they had to plea cruelty or desertion or whatever the state accepted as a grounds. And they also tended to worst case their plea because they wanted a good settlement. So I think you have to be very careful with the divorce petitions themselves. One other thing that I argue in the book is that if we look at divorce historically, it takes off some of the pressure of urbanization and industrialization and technology. We tend to say that divorce has been created by those factors. But if you go back and you see that we have had a high divorce rate already during the Victorian period, 1 out of 14, and that we've had a very high divorce rate in the Western states, which only recently have become urbanized and industrialized, then it makes you wonder how many divorces really were caused by industrialization and urbanization. And what I started to argue was that perhaps we need to look at the underlying philosophy Americans have of how they deal with problems. And we do tend to split when we're confronted by a problem. We left Europe, we left the British Empire, and I liken the Declaration of Independence to a great divorce petition. We went west. And even today, you don't like it, well, you go seek freedom, liberty, pursuit of happiness, whatever all that means. So I think that divorcing is a very logical way for Americans to deal with a personal problem, just as they have dealt with larger problems.
Have you found that the language of divorce has really changed? For instance, I don't think you hear that many people now talking about how their marriage failed.
Oh, absolutely. And that's one thing I did with this section on the self-help literature. The early manuals told people that they were a failure if their marriages ended. Those manuals told women, even in the 1940s, that they could expect stigma, they could expect to be cut off from their friends. By the 1950s, they were saying, well, you can live a life, you can get a job, and you can get satisfactions from your job that you might have gotten from a marriage. By the 1960s, they were starting to reject the concept of divorce as a failure and saying, well, sometimes this is necessary. It's a necessary amputation. By the 1970s, with the influence of the women's movement, they were urging women to think about ending marriages. And by the 1980s, divorce had become a self-fulfilling experience, a growth experience in the self-help literature. A radical change in thinking and language over those decades.
Glenda Riley, thank you very much for talking with us.
Well, thank you. It was fun.
Glenda Riley is the author of Divorce, an American Tradition. It's published by Oxford University Press. This is Fresh Air.